The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Tracy Seffel. Tracy is a nationally recognized communications specialist with a particular expertise in elite media and issue advocacy. As a media specialist, the New York Times has noted her ability to create media without fingerprints. That sounds both cool and ominous. She advises advocacy groups, labor unions, Fortune 500 companies, and she has served in war rooms for two presidential campaigns, including as a senior advisor for Hillary Clinton. Tracy, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you, Kelly.
Okay, so one of the things I absolutely love about preparing for these podcasts is the discovery of the digital footprint for each of my guests. So I don't want to scare you.
Speaking of ominous.
And because you have done so much public speaking on behalf of your candidates and clients, you got a pretty big digital footprint. But the item that caught my attention was in one of your bios that says you studied sociology and music at Cornell College. Now, I think this sociology part makes perfect sense as a precursor for your career, but I'm curious about how music factored in.
I grew up as a pianist. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to play piano in college.
Wow.
And my grandfather was a symphony musician. He actually played here and played elsewhere around the country. And I always felt like it was for him that I was pursuing music as potentially a career.
Right.
So as a major in college, mm-hmm. that was fun. I mm-hmm. taught children, for bar money and yep. that kind of thing. But it occurred to me probably sometime around my junior year that where was this going to take me?
Right.
So thankfully, I'd fallen in love with the study of sociology, and mm-hmm. that was the direction I chose to go. But music remains my passion. One of the most exciting discoveries I had coming to Chicago was discovering the People's Music School, which is uptown Chicago. This is pretty amazing. So allow me a plug.
Yeah, please.
They're the only school in the country that offers 100% free music lessons
wow.
to kids from underserved communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most amazing place. I love them. So I've hooked up with them. And that's how I keep music in my life.
Do you use music in, like, music theory, music ideas, the spirit of music in terms of your job?
Well, I certainly use music as a stress reliever. But in terms of what you're asking, I think of the music, I think of the jazz, I think of the tempos.
Right.
I think of news cycles in terms of tempos.
Beats.
Beats, exactly.
Yeah.
I hear music in some people's voices as well.
Right.
I hear phrasing and things like that. So I tend to, I guess that's me sort of overlaying music onto.
No, but there's a great Einstein quote, which is logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere.
Brilliant.
Right. And when I think about music, I love music and I'm a musician as well. I play guitar. That understanding a rhythm, finding a rhythm, especially with an audience, is a skill. I mean, Obama, brilliant at it as an orator.
Yes.
But now in this political campaign, you know, we've got some punk rock out there. We have some, right? We've got some traditional stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I guess we should say, you know, we're recording this podcast on the 7th. So this is the day after Hillary Clinton just clinched.
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
And how?
And you've worked with her, right?
I have. I first met her in the early 2000s mm-hmm. when I was working for the Democratic National Committee in D.C. And I'd always admired her. I'd never met her. And not only was she just as impressive in person, but she remembered my name in the course of the
always
event.
Huge.
So huge.
Yeah.
So little things like that make a big impression on me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I became a loyalist, worked for her in 08, worked on the Ready for Hillary Super PAC, and I do everything I can to help the campaign now.
I saw an article where you said that should she be elected president, or when she's elected president,
yes,
is how you'd like me to say it, that she'd be our first listener in chief.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't think I'll give you one example. When she began her campaign, which seems like 100 years ago, but really it was just about a year ago, she was sitting down with small groups of people in New Hampshire and Iowa and so forth. And from those conversations, one thing emerged for her, and it was the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. the addiction crisis. And she spoke about how people were coming up to her and sharing these devastating stories of loss and addiction in their families. And she has said she never, ever would have anticipated that this would be coming up on the presidential campaign trail. It didn't,
right.
It didn't seem to be of that level.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, okay, well, we're going to, you know, put policy to this. And Hillary being Hillary proceeded to unveil a pretty comprehensive and thoughtful policy on conquering opioid addiction and really addressing the crisis. She didn't expect that.
Right.
It wasn't sort of in the master plan. And I really commend her and anyone who's actually paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do believe she's a listener. She remembered my name, number one.
Yeah.
And she's taking those kinds of anecdotes from people and applying it to real policy.
So it was interesting because I was thinking about us talking about this, and I pulled out the Second City Almanac of Improvisation, which has all these awesome quotes that have been gathered, adages over the years. And one of them was, rather than focusing your energy on what you are going to say, focus on the point of view of the characters or the group's activity, which basically covers reading the room.
Absolutely.
Right, in my mind. And it's empathy. And it's understanding the zeitgeist and how all that works together. And to our earlier music conversation, right, it's the symphony that's going on.
Yes.
And you're trying to figure out each part because each part matters. But when it's all together is when things happen.
Uh-huh. Hear the sections,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah. I'm interested in your take on gender in communication. So I recently spoke to Christy Hefner, who really wasn't so much interested in gender differences in communication, but was more focused on how good leaders need to be able to communicate with all people. So they need to draw on both historically male and female communication traits.
Interesting. She's very cool, by the way.
Yeah, she is.
I will be listening to that one. For women in particular, the physical presence is of such importance for an audience. It's unavoidable, really.
Mm-hmm.
But a woman steps on a stage and she becomes the object. She is,
yeah,
looked at in a way very different than a man who steps on a stage. And I can remember I was watching C-SPAN because I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
And a senator came down to the floor to cast a vote, and I noticed she had a purse on her shoulder.
Hmm.
And you never, ever see women politicians carrying purses.
No.
It's like magic that they don't need to because,
yeah, right,
they
right.
have someone else who does it. But
yeah,
nonetheless, so I called up a reporter friend of mine and said, I think there's a piece here. You know, what is it, mm-hmm, about women politicians and their purses and whatnot? And some people really took issue with the reporting on this, that, well, it's so absurd. Why would you focus on something so trivial about a woman politician? You know, focus on her brain, focus on her,
right,
ideas. But for me, I believe that you as a woman know that you are being looked at in a different way.
Sure.
You carry a purse and it draws attention.
Mm-hmm.
For Hillary, it's the height of her heels. It's the make of her jacket. It's the, you know, the charm bracelet she may have on. And I truly believe that women can use that to their advantage.
Hmm.
It doesn't have to be seen as some sort of, you know, cultural failing.
Right.
But a woman can command an audience by remembering that her very appearance is of importance to the audience.
Well, totally. And I mean, there's a great improv adage about, you know, seeing any obstacle in front of you as a gift. And that requires a different kind of orientation. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, I mean, look, we're about to enter, you know, months and months of gender conversation. I know that is going to be at times horrifying. But it will at least be a conversation out in the open. And I think that's good. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I noticed, so my kids are 18 and soon to be 14. They and their friends are so much more evolved on these issues than anyone else of my age has been my you know, experience. Which, can we talk about Trump?
Dramatic pause.
We can.
When can we not talk about Trump? I mean, it's unavoidable. We have to. I think an intelligent conversation about Trump is much better than cable news Trump.
Let's try to have that then. So you, I saw a quote from you that you said Trump utilized a non-strategy strategy that was unpredictable, shameless, and unapologetic, which generally has seemed to be really working for him.
It sure has.
Why? How?
There was a story about how Trump has a very small campaign, and it was this, you know, oh, this is bad. He has a really small campaign, just like small hands, right?
Right.
But he also has the entire power of cable networks behind him.
Mm-hmm.
I see them on their worst days as being part of his campaign. They're an arm of his campaign.
Right.
He doesn't have a small campaign. He has a really large campaign.
Right,
and it
right,
involves,
right.
you know, Jeff Zucker and Rupert Murdoch and a whole lot of people making decisions about putting that orange face on TV.
And I would think the other thing about having a small group is it allows you to be way more nimble.
Sure. Sure. He's I think he disavowed some email that his own staff person had sent out.
And then admonished them. Yeah.
Admonished
on a phone call.
Great boss.
Yeah.
Great boss.
Did you see this Camille Paglia piece in Slate?
I did not.
Okay. So, or Salon. I'm sorry. It was in Salon last week. Here's what she wrote. There's an absurdist, almost Dadaist quality to Trump's candidacy, like Groucho Marx satirizing high society swells in A Night at the Opera, or the radical yippies trying to levitate the Pentagon at their 1967 anti-war protest. So I'm hearing some admiration in that quote.
Well, chutzpah, I think, is one way to think of it. But there is... I meant what I said about him being unapologetic, because he will throw out something that is so patently false.
Mm-hmm.
He will throw out something that he doesn't even believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it in a way that he can roll right into the next thing. He doesn't seem to have that human element of conscience.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Jiminy Cricket in Donald Trump's world.
Hmm. That's interesting. So I've written about the fact that Donald Trump, beyond politics, is a terrible improviser because he's not in the least bit others focused, which you need to be. And while I actually still believe that, I can't help but think he's tapping into a huge swath of discontentment in this country. So perhaps he does have some ability to hear and respond to the electorate in a way that other candidates haven't been able to. I mean, I think Bernie has that as well.
Absolutely.
They're hearing something.
Yes.
And they're responding to that.
Mm.
And I don't think I think this anger thing is too easy. To say if they're responding to the anger in the country. Is there something else? Is there?
Well, you know, if Hillary's a listener in chief on a policy level, I could see the case being made that Bernie and Trump are listeners on a visceral level. So it is more than anger.
Yeah.
But it's about understanding why there's such pervasive racism in this country. It's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And he manipulates that.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the current brouhaha over his incredibly racist and frankly stupid comments about a judge.
Right.
He's talking to someone else. He's not talking to you or me.
Mm-hmm.
He is very much focused on an audience that he knows is out there.
Well, and again, back to music, you know, this is the song that's being played today.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know when this podcast is being aired because sometimes it takes a few weeks to get
sure.
up. But, you know, in 2 weeks, is the song going to be different? And because 2 weeks ago, Trump was leading the band.
Yep.
I mean, it was looking to me like, well, this could go he's got this maybe.
Right. He was leading the band. He was also a soloist.
And a soloist. Yeah. You know, and now, you know, the drumsticks are broken or something. This metaphor is just terrible. We got to stop doing it.
We can take it a little farther. I mean, I would like for someone to unplug the amp.
Yeah,
but,
well.
You know, 2 weeks from now, whenever that may be, I expect Trump to continue to be a bloviator. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to get an easier ride from the media, but it might become, as we're seeing, it's going to get a little harder for him. People are actually going to ask him real questions. The thing is, that doesn't mean he's going to answer them.
No.
He's really the worst possible collaborator in that regard
as an
interview subject. He's
not listening
to a thing being said.
No, not at all. So, you know, we first met because we were both speakers at an event for Chicago Ideas Week, right?
Yeah, that was great.
And you told a story about getting into a minor car accident.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Can you recount a bit of that story? Because I think it's amazing.
Well, thank you for thinking that this is amazing, because it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very minor car accident in Washington, D.C. on my way to my office.
Like a fender bender?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Couple cars. And we pulled over and some cops came and a couple EMTs strolled up. And, you know, it was a very nobody was too concerned.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, the EMTs said, hey, everybody should go get checked out. So I quite reluctantly turned around, went home and went to the emergency room, and they hear car crash, you know, or the car accident, and they implement a rather aggressive protocol with an ER patient. So I was kind of strapped down and tests were being run. And I was like, you guys, I'm not hurt. My car's fine.
Right.
You know, this feels like this is what's wrong with American healthcare. You know? But in the course of that, a doctor came rushing back into the room or the little drape area where I was sitting and said, oh, you've hit your head and you have a massive injury. And I'm like, is he in the wrong room? I mean, what is this? But actually they had discovered a massive brain tumor that I did not know I had. It was asymptomatic. And as I learned over the course of my treatment then, the only symptom I would have experienced would have been death. That was it, if it got just that little bit bigger. So I was in the care of an amazing neurosurgeon, and he would often say, you know, there was some sort of angel who caused that car accident, because I would have never known. I mean, who thinks, oh, well, gee, I better make sure I don't have a brain tumor. But I did, and I don't anymore. And I'm grateful for that totally bizarre little car accident.
Yeah. I mean, there's a term that we use called make mistakes work for you.
Sure as hell did.
If they can save your life, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
How do you come out the other side of that? What, you know, do you look at your days differently pre-discovery, pre-accident to the person you are after that?
I had a fair amount of time off after surgery just to kind of get back to the swing of things. 8 years ago, actually, it coincided with Hillary dropping out in a way.
Wow.
Some people get really angry when they hear someone say, no regrets in life, no regrets in life.
Right.
But I firmly believe in that. And maybe that's another way of saying make mistakes work.
Right.
Because no matter what the fuck up is,
right,
I believe that there's a reason. And
yeah.
I hate that that's cliche, because it is truly what I believe.
I saw a quote that you said, the reason I got into politics was to improve people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you doing that?
If they deserve it.
some people's lives.
I can also worsen some people's lives. Yes, that is part of what I do. But I hope that that's what is driving all of politics at the end of the day. It's the selfishness of politics is unfortunate, and the egotism that fuels any candidate. I mean, think about what an ego you have to actually think someone would elect you.
Right.
It's just, it's like, it's a given. You have a big ego if you run for office. So I would hope that despite all that, it is about making people's lives better.
So let's talk about that with the ego thing, because one of the things that, that I've worked with a lot of famous people, a lot of people are super famous, but when I worked with them, they weren't, because so many people that you don't know them when they started Second City. But the vast majority, and I mean the vast majority, probably 90 to 95% of these very famous people I know are also good people. They are polite. They are kind. They have huge egos. They know it, but they also know how to sublimate that ego to work with everyone. Okay, you know a ton of famous politicians, right?
Mm, yeah.
What's your ratio? I know by the look on your face, is not the same.
It's not the same.
No,
it's not, and that applies to people around politicians as well. Some
right.
people who have been made famous by virtue of working for a candidate. Those people fall into that same category.
Is that what's screwing up politics?
Maybe.
I mean, you know, you live in, you're not from here, but you live in Chicago. You've lived here for about 3 or 4 years?
Two now. 2 years.
So you have a front row seat to our dysfunction.
Good
I mean,
Lord, what a mess.
Right. These people need an improv class.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be able to model behaviors of listening to each other, of collaborating together, of attempting to build, to get past differences or use differences mm-hmm. to find answers. And they're not even acting. It's as if you know, we all bought tickets to the show, but they're just refusing to actually perform.
They do need improv. They also need music lessons.
Yeah, that too.
So I don't understand how the governor and his wife can coexist. That to me is the most amazing typification of what's happening in politics in Chicago and in Illinois. I mean, he's preventing her from accomplishing her work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do they talk about at dinner? It's stunning to me.
Yeah.
I'm pretty fascinated by that.
Well, and the city's not much better. I mean, you know,
no,
it's just, you know, especially you look at the school situation, right? And there's some very good people in there, people I know and
sure.
like and respect, a lot
sure.
of them. But they're not working together. People aren't working together.
No.
And they're not choosing to listen.
And that's so, so sad. I think about, you know, just those kids up at the People's Music School, and they're
right.
never going to have that class in a Chicago public school. Thank God they can go get them somewhere
else. Yeah. All right. So what's the deal with you and Matt Drudge? someone called you like the Drudge Whisperer in some article.
Well, it's starting to feel a little bit archaic, I think, because of the age of Twitter and BuzzFeed, and sort of Drudge has become a bit of a relic,
yes.
in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay.
No offense, Matt, but I think he would agree. So he's an enigma.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who's followed anything in media knows about Matt Drudge. And he and I sort of, how did we met, I think, on Instant Messenger.
Really?
And we discovered an affinity. I had a cat, and he has many cats, and so we would...
Did cat talk with Matt Drudge?
We had
Drudge.
Cat talk, yeah. Cat talk.
You bonded over cats.
We did.
That's amazing.
And my husband and I went down to Miami a couple times, hung out, went to his house. That was fascinating. It was gorgeous views. And he actually came with me when Hillary conceded in 2008 and gave her amazing glass ceiling speech. And he wanted to come just, you know, to see the spectacle of it all.
Right.
He also was a really nice guy and knew that I was recovering from neurosurgery. And he, he wanted to see if I was doing okay.
Wow.
So a totally bizarre figure.
Because you don't share the same political POV.
No, but he also... He knew what side his bread was buttered on, and
mm-hmm.
all things Clinton have made him into who he is.
Oh, well, that's a good point. There's that great Churchill quote about never letting a good crisis go to waste. Do you like to use the crisis, or do you like to sidestep?
Oh, I am pro-crisis.
Okay.
I am get in there and roll up my sleeves and figure out what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I also find it fascinating, sort of from a sociological point of view, you know, the There was a great book on the Challenger explosion and how that crisis was analyzed and turned into opportunities for fixing systems and things like that. But kind of a visceral example there.
Yeah.
But, you know, like think about a company like Chipotle, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Heck of a crisis for that company.
Right.
And so what do you do and how do you fix that? I love those questions.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm going to say I have admiration for Domino's, but I do in terms of what they did.
Uh-huh.
They came out and said, our pizza is bad. sorry, we're going to make it better.
Uh-huh.
And it worked.
Absolutely. And there's so many interesting examples of that, you know, sort of in commercial space.
Yeah.
And in political space, it becomes a little different. You know, think about Anthony Weiner. Everyone's saying that the documentary about him is so good.
Oh, I can't believe you haven't seen it. I have heard. I mean, it is.
Rave reviews,
yeah.
Right? I'm a little afraid to see it. That it hits
the squirm factor.
Yeah, I know.
I think the thing is that the unprecedented access to raw stuff.
For sure.
And you know, I'm totally going to see it.
Oh, well, we should go together then because my husband refuses.
Okay, great. That's a date. Okay, I can't believe this is coming to the end. These things go so quickly. So, one of the things we always ask of our guest, it's the only thing we ask in advance, right, is do you have a yes and story? Is there a time in your life where you maybe would have said no, should have said no, maybe did say no, and what happened? What was the result of that?
Kelly, you said that all of your guests say that their stories are weird.
Yes.
Okay.
Every time I've done this thing, everyone qualifies it with like, this is not probably what you want. And then it ends up being like exactly what I want.
Okay. Well, that.
No pressure.
Yeah. I was going to say, now I feel even more scared to tell this story because it is so weird. But I have my whole life or my adult life, I've had a phobia. The only phobia I have.
Okay.
Of rats.
Yeah.
They're disgusting. Mm-hmm. I cry if I see one. I scream, I do my full-blooded, soprano scream and they scare me. So I never saw rats in Iowa where I grew up. I never saw them. I didn't ever think about it. Didn't think about it until I lived in Washington D.C.
Oh, and plenty of rats there.
They're everywhere. It's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember I was seeing a really great therapist who said to me, you know, maybe not because of this, for other reasons.
That's fine.
But somehow it came up. And
I'm not Mike Wallace. I'm not going to dig into this. Keep going.
But she said, well, you know, you should just go online and look at pictures of them. And you know, that like aversion therapy kind of thing.
Sure.
And I couldn't do that. It horrified me too much to do that. So then we moved here 2 years ago and discovered quite quickly that our neighborhood is kind of rat central.
Oh.
And it's very hard for me to describe just how horrified I am by these creatures. But I had to really work on it. I have to walk the dog. I have to be outside. So I have all these strategies, you know, where I look up. I will never look down because God only knows what I'm going to see.
Mm-hmm.
But quite bizarrely, I was approached by someone for a business project who said, you know, this we've got a product. We're going to be bringing it to market. It's incredible. It's really transformative. And it has to do with rats.
Oh, no.
And I just about lost it. I thought it was actually someone was playing a joke on me.
Right.
And they proceeded to talk at great length about this company and about what the potential was and the product, basically working to eradicate rats through their fertility, which, that's the way you do it.
Yeah.
So I'm having this conversation with these people. Like, they're completely serious.
Yeah, and they don't know what's going on in your head.
I'm dying.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm dying. I have my feet off the ground.
Yep.
I can't even.
Yep.
But I said, of course, I will help you. This is a good cause.
You yes-anded the rat thing.
I yes-anded the rat. And now when I see them, I don't scream quite as loud.
See, this is the best story ever. The rat story is awesome.
It's disgusting.
Right, but it's true disgusting. And it's real and it's authentic.
And maybe I will have helped eradicate them. That would be the best outcome ever.
We're ending this podcast about killing rats.
Yes, we are. Not about politics.
No, well, some would say.
What is it?
Thanks, Tracy.
Thanks, Kelly.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down, working.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.